Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. This is the second course on my second book, Bitcoin Independence Reimagined, and today's chapter is called Why Collectivists Win. I'm Knut Swanholm, and I'm here as always with Luke DeWolf. How are you today, Luke?
I'm doing great, Knut. Excited for this one. Yeah, Why Collectivists Win should be an interesting one. Before we dive in, I'll just remind everyone that the best way to get involved with this project is to check out our project on Geyser Fund, geyser.fund/project/infinity. You can find all the information about how to get involved. You can join the live recordings of these episodes. And you can, basically, it's the best way to support this initiative. So check that out. Anything to add before we start, Knut?
Yeah, I should mention that this chapter is available as an animated video by Yoni Appleberg. That's I-O-N-I, Appleberg. And if you just search for his name on YouTube, you'll find his YouTube channel, and it should be somewhere in there. We'll put the link in the show notes too, but there's a neat little animated video.
Perfect. All right, let's dive in.
Absolutely.
Okay. Why collectivists win. People in general want to be free to do whatever they want with their lives. Even left-wingers seem to have their personal freedoms as an end goal, even though personal freedom means something else to them than it does to those actually capable of supporting themselves. A lot of people see welfare as an opportunity to live their lives as they want, as starving artists, hermits, bums, or junkies. If you're a nihilist, depressed, or just not very materialistic, you might think that living off of social welfare for the rest of your life is actually a viable option. It's not really immoral to crave as little as possible, is it? Nor does it really deprive you of your freedoms, does it? Well, ask a Venezuelan what he thinks about such claims. The problem with giving away more and more power to politicians is that you become defenseless when the system implodes, which it inevitably does one day. Once a draconian law, a bureaucratic institution, or an infringement of your right to freedom of thought is in place, it is very hard to remove it again without an outright revolution. A revolution is always violent and hardly guarantees any better shot at independence than what you had before, though. Okay, I'll pause here. We were talking before we started that this chapter is a little stream of consciousness and all this, but we'll pause here and give you some time to explain your thoughts, Knut. What were you thinking here?
Yeah, this is talking about the left and the right here and the different views on freedom and what freedom implies. I think the Misesian definition of freedom is the sphere in which you are free to choose from different modes of action. So from a praxeological standpoint, freedom means freedom from other people's interference. It doesn't mean that you get to break the laws of nature or anything like that. So I think this is what I'm alluding to here. It's a long time since I wrote this, but it has the same undertone as all of my other writings, I think.
Absolutely. Well, and the point that comes to my mind here in seeing this is that, yeah, there's definitely a bunch of people. I know some personally, I think most of us do, who think this way, that basically it should be fine for society to take care of unproductive people, basically.
Yes.
And that there's some kind of human right to clothing, shelter, food, all of this, that if you don't want to be productive to society, you should still get those things for free. And it's just, it's so pernicious because it basically plays off of empathy, for lack of a better word, and that there's some kind of idea that you shouldn't have to play the game of capitalism in order for to have the basic needs of life fulfilled. But the thing is, someone has to provide those things. And the answer that all of these collectivists want to give for this is that, well, the government should just provide that. We live in a society and the government should just provide all of these things. But the government is ultimately people, and they're paying for it with other people's money.
Yeah, and a great point. And I mean, UBI is one of the things. I think I get into that a bit later here in this book, even in this chapter, perhaps. Universal basic income, like the fears around AI taking all jobs are somewhat, they're not entirely unfounded. But what people don't get is that any technological progress, any new technology, what it actually does is it makes humans more efficient. But since we live in this redistributive system, or systems, there can be a fear that that money will be funneled into the wrong hands, or it won't be distributed evenly or whatever. But the thing is, if you let the free market do its thing, then all costs drop to the marginal cost of production, which is approaching zero. So a sound money global free market is the ones that have the most to gain from that are the poorest people in the world, because lower prices benefits them more than it benefits the billionaires. So this is what often gets lost in the fear, so that the government should just hand out stuff. Like, yeah.
Good stuff. And I think this, yeah, we should just continue here a little bit, because I think we're going to touch on some similar points in the coming pages, and then we'll build and build and build, et cetera. So,
yes, exactly.
One. Yeah. Good. People keep voting for more and more government interference while they keep complaining about the government interfering in their lives too much. Why? Let's examine what attributes define a specific voter. An individualist voter tends to care less about what others think about his political views than his collectivist counterpart. A person who cares about what others think of his opinions is, by definition, less individualistic than a person who doesn't. What this inevitably leads to in a democracy is that individualists will tend to vote for a greater number of, hence smaller, parties than collectivists will. A collectivist naturally tends to care more about belonging to a group, per se, and less about what that group actually wants. Individualists, on the other hand, are less agreeable than collectivists, because whether they share their opinions with others or not matters far less to them than it does to the collectivists. In other words, collectivists form larger groups more easily than individualists. This is one of the most subtle, yet most dangerous pitfalls of democracy itself. In the long run, every government, every state institution, and every politician is bound to become corrupt, because the forces that spawned them were more concerned with tribalism than individual rights. Psychopaths thrive in such environments. There's just no way of telling if a seemingly polite and friendly political leader is really a cold-hearted, calculating monster underneath his facade. Okay, so a good chunk about democracy and individualists versus collectivists.
Yeah, this is the main thesis of this chapter, that collectivists form larger groups than individualists, simply because they're collectivists and individualists don't care about what groups they belong to. In Bitcoin, for instance, you have all sorts of different opinions on almost everything, from the most technical detail to how to do economics and what religion is appropriate. And like, Bitcoiners are very diverse when it comes to opinions about stuff. And especially, I think also there's a correlation between disagreeableness and how early you were into Bitcoin. So you get the nicer Bitcoiners now that Bitcoin is like 15 years old. But in the beginning, it was all people who were very eccentric, very individualistic, and very different from one another. And that's a good thing in the free market, of course. But this is to say that this page, I think the TLDR of it is that democracy is inherently leftist. Being a collectivist is rewarded in democratic systems. It's skewed towards leftism in this sense. Or collectivism.
Right. And I don't think necessarily that this was an intention of the system originally. It's just one of these emergent properties, basically, that there's this naivety that the will of the people is always going to be right or something like this. But yeah, if 51% of the people agree that they want the government to give them stuff, they get the stuff given to them, is basically what the system works out to. Never mind if the other 49% is the one that makes all the money and provides the stuff for those 51%. So it's all skewed. I've thought about plenty of ways of reforming democratic systems, which some are more politically correct than others. One of them, for example, being that you only get to vote if you are a net taxpayer, for example. That would solve a lot of issues, really. Another one is that family units get the vote, something like that. Like, I think one of the most, the slightly less politically correct ones is that only a married couples, married family units should be allowed to vote, something like that. Then there's various things like you have to hold land or whatever it is. They all have their own set of bad incentives, but regardless, they all also reward people with a vote if they are at least somewhat productive and lower time preference than others.
This is very close to the original Greek democracies, like the Aristotelian version of it, where only property owners got to vote. And if you think about it, why should people who are on the receiving end of what gets expropriated by the government or stolen by the government, why should the people on the receiving end of that have a say in how to distribute it? Like, and that is the inherent flaw that that skews all incentives towards contributing less and taking more, which is the pitfall.
Absolutely. And so I think we're going to get a little more into this here, but yeah, definitely it's a very prescient and good point that, yeah, the collectivists tend to group together and that lets them win the system. So shall we continue?
Yep.
It's depressingly easy to get a political or even a religious belief to be considered an intersubjective truth. You can count on an enormous amount of pre-existing credulity among illiterate, frightened, ill-educated populations. In Sweden, we were repeatedly told about every human's equal value in school. As I recall, none of the kids ever questioned this. No one ever mentioned that value might not even be something you can measure because of its subjective nature. Those asking the really hard questions are seldom rewarded for doing so by the group, no matter what type of group we are talking about. The larger the group, the more intolerant it becomes of the skeptic. Or as George Orwell put it, the further a society drifts from the truth, the more it will hate those that speak it. Political correctness is a perfect example of this phenomenon. The words climate denier and Islamophobe are examples of how even our language has changed in order for the mainstream to quell undesired opinions. Most people labeled with these epithets are merely critical of the way the world is presented to them by mainstream media, and not in denial or phobic by any stretch of the imagination. The word denier implies that there is an absolute truth somewhere that ought not be questioned by serious thinkers. What this truth actually consists of is unclear, though, since those who just refuse to buy into the idea that politicians can change the weather are labeled in the same way as those who actually question scientific data. Those who criticize religious dogma are labeled as phobic towards the people who identify as belonging to that particular religious group. All right. Intersubjective reality and political correctness.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's equal value. I remember that from growing up and school. And it's a great big lie because no other person is equally valuable to any other person ever. It's all dynamic. Valuations are subjective and dynamic. I mean, I care more about my kids than I care about, Donald Trump or Joe Biden. it's obvious. So, but that thing being hammered into our heads in the publicly funded or tax victim funded public schools is one of the things that makes the kids think that resources are distributed unfairly as the world is, and that they ought to be redistributed more fairly and more equally. And this is a super dangerous thought because that's just not how justice works. It's not respecting the fact that you have to steal and like push everyone down to their levels to the great people do get equal from socialism, but they get equal in the same sense as they get equal from an earthquake or a hurricane or a tsunami or something. Everything is destroyed and there's nothing left and everyone has zero. So if that's a noble goal or a desirable goal, I leave that up to the listener to evaluate, but I certainly don't think it is. That's true.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and I mean, we've talked about that particular phenomenon before, but I really like the point here of the more intolerant, the larger the group, the more intolerant it becomes of the skeptic. That's really interesting. Like there's this thing that you must follow the line, you must follow the doctrine, you must follow the propaganda. And it's really been this last decade and a half that things have been just ridiculously bonkers, clown world, if you will. It's always been the case. There have, of course, been strains of political propaganda as long as mass media has been in effect. And before mass media, it was printed books and this and that. And I think going back 25, 30 years ago, the political propaganda machines were a little more heavy on the right, for example, like the Fox News's and all this pushing the propaganda of the George Bush administration that we have to put up with a war in Iraq and everything like that. That was what the so-called left railed against, and it was part of the line you had to toe, sort of in the cultural milieu of the Americas at the time. But it completely flipped, and now obviously, I mean, back at the time when this was written, I think political correctness was like really, really an issue, and I think it was the last 5 to 10 years that was like when you had the Jordan Petersons of the world, and the intellectual dark web was pushing back against this sort of thing. I don't think that really went away, but it certainly morphed, and the Trump 2.0 has really started to flip the things on its head. Like there's a massive pushback against this political correctness and towing that line. And now maybe we're even seeing the pendulum swing fully in the other direction, like late night talk show hosts getting canceled, which my point of view on that is simply that the private company that gave them the show is deciding that they don't want to give them the show anymore, probably also because of very, very poor ratings. But there's some screeching going on about free speech being violated. But yeah, it's complicated. Yeah. Large collectivist societies insisting on towing the line. It's a problem.
Yeah, and the thing you said about the Bush administration, I mean, right-wingism is just another variety of collectivism. It doesn't matter if it's right-wing or left-wing. It's still expropriating and taking stuff from the public and spending it on. It's usually just what they spend it on. So the right wants to spend it more on military and police and stuff, and the left wants to spend it on you know, gay shit. But I mean, it's okay to say gay and retarded now that Trump is in office. I've heard. Allegedly, it's okay. But it's all the same. Like, the Trump administration has not ended the Fed. There are still taxes in America. They're imposing tariffs. There's a lot. Like, it's not the remedy that people think it is. Like, the system is still in place, and it does grow. National debt grows exponentially, and it's all very bad. So, politics is not the way out of the system. Politics is the system. The way out is to use a type of money that they cannot stop you from using and that they cannot counterfeit. And that's what we're all about.
I think you're skipping two sections ahead here. Not that it's, of course, we always talk about that, but I think it gets into the Bitcoin of it after the next one. But I think we can have a little bit of discussion about Christopher Hitchens before that. What do you think?
Yeah, if you want to. This is one of my idols, a very great debater from the whole. He was one of the four horsemen of new atheism.
Well, let me read the thing first, and then you can say your stuff.
I thought you wanted to talk about him before the thing. But
no,
okay.
I want to read the thing, and then we can talk about him.
All right, read the thing.
A lot can be said about the late Christopher Hitchens and his criticism of religion, but you can hardly say that he was phobic of Muslims. On the contrary, he confronted religious leaders without fear all the time. On the other side of the political aisle, the word pro-life comes to mind, which implies that all those in favor of liberal abortion laws are murderers. As discussed earlier, speech is the only tool we humans have, apart from violence, to resolve our conflicts. And this type of political censorship of our language always seems to stem from political or religious groupthink. Large flocks of people mimicking each other's behavior can be a very scary thing, as those who have ever found themselves in the midst of a riot can attest to. The most hideous atrocities ever committed against humans have all been made possible by armies of collectivists following orders and not questioning the morality of their actions. All right, go.
So you want me to talk about Christopher Hitchens?
Well, you can talk about whatever you want.
I think people should look him up. There's some great debates. If not for anything else than just for his rhetoric skills and his debating skills, because he was a very good public speaker. Anyway, this is to say that, once again, that both sides of the political aisle are capturable by words and by implying that some terms are inherently wrong. And it's back to we have two tools to solve conflicts. It's communication or violence. And the road to hell is paved with good intentions. That's what the last sentence here alludes to. We're enabling wars and all sorts of nasty stuff by being good citizens and paying our taxes and using their currency.
Yeah, it lets the people who have the levers of power to use them more effectively. I think this is the big thing that the leftists don't get. They simply get pacified by the government giving them the gibs, but they don't. But the government keeps being allowed to do all of the nasty things, as you say, running the wars and suppressing the ability for individuals to make the world a better place. Yeah, it's nasty. Yeah. And I don't like to speculate on why people with power seem to do things that are just against the interests of most people around the world. I don't know why they do that. Like it's like you get to a certain level of the cool kids club of the cantillionaires, so to say, and your mind just starts getting warped. I don't know. Maybe there's some self-selecting bias, but it's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you're a psychopath and if you're willing to lie about absolutely everything and, you know, walk over corpses to get to where you, to a position of power, then this system is for you. Like it's designed for you to get on top. And it's not only left-wingers, it's the left and the right. It's the same mistake. It's taking stuff and using it for violent shit that people in general don't want.
Definitely. But now maybe we can talk a little bit about the potential solution in the next section.
Yeah, we're coming to that.
Let's continue. If you're honestly frightened about whatever political direction your nation seems to be headed in, you have two options. You can either stay in the illusion, believe that your vote will account for something, and hope that everything will magically sort itself out one day, or you can choose to try to regain a little control over your own destiny. Just like in the movie The Matrix from 1999, you have a choice. As the character Morpheus says, "This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more." Bitcoin offers you a similar choice. To properly understand Bitcoin and why you need it, you must first see the world as it truly is, and you might not like what you're about to find out. A curious mind just can't help itself, though, now, can it? What do you think, Knut?
Yeah, it's the famous Matrix analogy. This is what the orange pill does. It provides you with truth goggles. If you start viewing the world through a Bitcoin lens, you can see that all prices drop on a free market and everyone's better off. Bitcoin is peace. Bitcoin is hope. All of that. It's all right there in front of your eyes if you just dare to take the orange pill. It's that simple. Satoshi was literally Morpheus offering you an orange pill.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the funny thing is, I'm not sure that Satoshi or whoever was involved in the early days of Bitcoin foresaw that things would happen like this, but it really becomes clear that it is the choice of one system over the other. Like Jeff Booth has really been talking about this these days, right? The main thing here is that we're dealing with a system that is entrenched, and there is really no way out of it. Through the current one, right? Like we're not voting out the entire system. The MAGA Republicans thought, or maybe had some idea that they were going to drain the swamp and everything, but the swamp continues. Maybe it looks a little different. Maybe it's a little less effective than it used to be. But they still have control over the money supply, as you said, and they still have control over, well, the ability to send armies to places and bomb stuff and all this. So, yeah, opt out. Like, it really is as simple as that. And I mean, we've been having some conversations with people in episodes of our main show that are going to come out soon that are working within the system to try and make things better within the current system. And I do see some value in that. But they're also Bitcoiners, though. I think maybe there is a little bit of extra confidence or even extra, there's some extra power you will wield by knowing that you're not beholden to the existing system. And what you choose to do with that power is up to you. But you need to opt out.
With great powers comes great responsibility. So yeah, to echo what Jeff said in Helsinki, the Bitcoin and the dollar cannot coexist simply because Bitcoin is the antidote to the dollar. It's the antidote to counterfeiting. That's the very problem it solves. It solves central banking. No one gets to print money. So fiat governments print are the only ones that get to print money. Crypto, everyone gets to print money, and Bitcoin, no one gets to print money. This is the difference between the three. And so this is the only one that provides you its own money. It's super simple.
Perfect. Let's continue discussing about Bitcoin then. One thing a curious mind ought to be capable of doing is memorizing 24 words. Since memorizing 24 words enables you to cross any border in the world with any amount of money in your head, this is nothing short of a superpower to a Venezuelan refugee or a Chinese dissident. Information has always been a valuable thing. But since the inception of Bitcoin, information can literally hold intersubjective value. Of course, value is still a subjective thing, but the intersubjectivity of something we can define as money can be a very useful tool. You don't have to remember all of the 24 words either. Just remembering four of them should provide you with enough entropy to create a time slot long enough to travel from one jurisdiction to another with any amount of wealth in your memory, enabling you to recover the whole seed phrase and with it access to your Bitcoin, if you recombine them with the 20 other words which you had already submitted to the destination before. This is just one of the ways in which Bitcoin will inevitably make the nation state obsolete. All right, I think that was already getting at some kind of interesting ideas, the whole 24 words thing.
Yeah, it's the magic internet money thing. Like, it still baffles me that information is money now. It's so powerful. I remember the first time I printed a paper wallet with a Bitcoin address on them and scanned the QR code, put the paper in an envelope, and then sent the sats into the envelope. And I was like, that was a mind blow moment for me, because I could actually beam the information into a walled thing. So I could literally beam money into a bank vault or out of it if I was doing it the other way. So money as information is such a powerful, super powerful thing. It changes everything. It really does. And also to your point on the last paragraph there with the what you do in the efforts in fiat land right now and the efforts in Bitcoin, like I tend to think long term and extrapolate the thought vectors into Ancapistan, the hyper Bitcoinized world, right? But there are a lot of people doing good work in the current system and providing rails, and that is important in the transition. It's important temporarily, but in the long run, like, Bitcoin fixes all of this stuff. So we need all kinds of people and all kinds of thinkers and doers and builders to get from one to the other. I was in a Spaces the other day with a lot of finance people talking about Bitcoin. All of them were talking about Bitcoin, but they lumped it together with like gold and other cryptos and all sorts of stuff. And it felt like no one in the room was an actual Bitcoiner. Everyone was just seeing it from this, oh, here's another commodity kind of perspective, which is sort of missing the point. And I was trying to say that, like, they were talking about the value of real estate and stuff, and no one seemed to see that if you just use Bitcoin as the denominator, you can see that real estate is not a good investment. It goes down in price, like your house is dropping in price. You're just denominating it in the wrong unit with the wrong unit. So yeah, it's still today most Bitcoiners don't actually see the world through this lens.
Sure, and there's something to this as well that what Bitcoin does is subtle. And I think people who are outside of it, who see this as like this ever snowballing tulips or beanie babies or something like this, it's demand propped up by demand, something like this. They don't see that there's just a subtle shift that happens when you understand the power of what it is. And the things like the 24 magic words or 12 magic words or whatever it is, yeah, as that is an innovation, that is a change. And the price isn't really something that reflects that. And, you know, we've been in maybe a slightly disappointing few years of price action. Like, it's fantastic that we're above 100K US dollars, blah, blah, blah. But I think many of the so-called crypto bros and stuff thought that we would be a lot further along here. You know, your power law people or your plan B, whatever, astrology for men people.
Not Plan B education. The other plan, the guy called Plan
B. The guy called
there's
Plan B.
There's a lot of Plan Bs out there.
Yeah. Not our fun friends at Plan B Network. No, but yeah, it's just when you switch your mind to it, there is an innovation there, and it's something absolutely valuable. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I put 24 words instead of 12 to hedge against the nasty comments on Twitter that or something. But yeah, 12 words work too. It truly is. And ones and zeros could theoretically work too, if you can memorize a string of those. I love this. When you see that, you've seen it on Twitter, I think, the picture of all the words in the, what is it, BIP38, the seed words, the seed words dictionary, and they're all crammed into one picture. And the tweet usually goes something like, here's all the Bitcoins in the world. But I always point out that 10, that's also all the Bitcoins in the world. Like, you don't need the words. It's just information. It's just, at its core, it's just super small on and off switches on a circuit board. That's the ones and zeros. That's what it is.
Definitely. And I think on that, the next paragraph makes some similar assertions. So let's continue. Can a nation hold Bitcoin? Can a bank? It is often speculated that nations, banks, and institutional investors are going to start stockpiling Bitcoin. But Bitcoin is not just another currency or asset. They cannot be owned by a non-existing intersubjective entity in the way traditional money can. It is even questionable whether they can be owned at all, since all that owning Bitcoin means is that the owner has access to them by holding the private keys to a certain Bitcoin address. A nation-state is made up of people. So is a bank. And so is any other man-made institution. Someone in the allegedly Bitcoin-owning institution would have to be entrusted with the private keys. Of course, there are multi-sig setups, and you could picture a nation holding Bitcoin in a way similar to that in which nuclear missiles are handled in Hollywood movies. A room with multiple literal keys for a bunch of uniform-wearing minions to turn simultaneously when a big red telephone rings and the president commands them to do so. The difficulties an institution would have in holding Bitcoin illuminates a bigger problem. Even in our current system, there is ultimately a need to trust a single individual at the very end of each ownership chain. Institutions aren't real. Banks, and even more so central banks, are only possible because of people's belief in the validity of what used to be a receipt for a specific amount of gold deposited at that bank, the banknote. There's quite a lot here. Where do you want to start?
This is the not your keys, not your coins still applies point that I try to make all the time, especially now in this era of Bitcoin treasury companies and ETFs and strategic Bitcoin reserves and such. At the end of the day, some guy at Coinbase actually controls those Bitcoin. And the rest is paper Bitcoin, and it's just paper Bitcoin is just Bitcoin with a ton of added risk. So I don't invest in Bitcoin treasury companies. Jimmy Song made a great video about that the other day on one of his little video logs, because there's so much risk added. Like, Bitcoin works the same way as it did 10 years ago. The basics are still there. And the basics are, if you not your keys, not your coins. That's the mindset that Bitcoiners ought to have. If we don't, if enough of us don't, then Bitcoin is more vulnerable to attacks and it might not work in the long run. So we need to, that's like the most basic thing. Take control of your own keys. Otherwise, this is not a revolution. It's just another financial tool for fiddly aroundy spreadsheet people in suits to fiddle around with. Fiat around and find out. It's the fiat aroundest of times. It's the fucker find outest of times. And people who fiddle around and fiat around will find out eventually.
You know, the funny thing here that comes to mind for me is that even though there's this not your keys, not your coins, and yeah, when everyone's getting into these, like, can institutions really hold them? Can nations really hold them? And it all comes down to individuals and all this. The thing here, if I'm playing the devil's advocate at all, is that these institutions and nations and whatever are a collection of individuals who are agreeing on a specific thing, right? And if part of that agreement is that together we are holding the Bitcoin, it sort of doesn't matter on a technical perspective how that Bitcoin is held. Now, it does if someone is going to run away with the money. But yeah, if that person runs away with the money and there was an agreement that would generally be considered valid by the community and all this, well, you can validly go grab that person and say, well, give us the money back, or, you know, we will do things to you that you might not enjoy as consequence.
Yeah, if you can find that person and if you even know who it is, like, that's the thing. You don't own Bitcoin. You just know a string of, you know, some information about the private key, and you find it very implausible that other people also know that string of information. But so that's not really ownership. It's just a way you can act as if you own them. But at the end of the day, it's just information and knowing something that no one else knows. However, I'd say some good things about this Bitcoin treasury companies. They do allow coin to flow from boomery, fiat savings thingies, pools of the fiat money that were not accessible to the Bitcoin spigot before. So now money can flow from the boomers into the Bitcoin ecosystem via these treasury companies. So that's a good thing. But the point I'm making here is the point that I'm still trying to make every time I talk to people about this, and that is that the not your keys, not your coins, it still applies.
Yeah, and I think ultimately it just means that every individual needs to take the safeguards to make sure that they're not going to get rugged by other people, right? Like, for example, holding one key of a multi-sig, or that there is some trusted third party that holds the Bitcoin. I know that's a bad thing to say, but if it safeguards, if you'd rather have your Bitcoin with a third party instead of with the individuals of your little group, and that keeps trust in the group together, like, yeah, it's bad, definitely, that Coinbase custody is holding most of the ETF Bitcoin, but how else would you do it, sort of?
Yeah.
Like if we're really playing the incentives out, maybe trusting another entity who has some kind of legal obligation and says that they will give you your Bitcoin if you need it, maybe that prevents conflicts between individuals.
No,
right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not telling people what to do and what not to do. All I'm trying to do is raise awareness of how it actually works. Because people, like, you're right. Like, for a lot of people and a lot of situations, it's better to trust a third party. And that's, but I want to raise awareness in Bitcoiners of what you're actually doing when you're giving away that trust. Like, this system is based on don't trust, verify. That's the core of it. If that isn't there, if not enough people run nodes and stuff, then the system is fucked. It's not backed by energy. It's backed by human action and human beings actively choosing to run nodes and verify that the Bitcoin that they get are proper Bitcoins and not bullshit. And it has to work that way.
Totally agree. I think we can wrap up with the last couple of paragraphs here. Let's continue. Even today, when people ought to know that no currency in the world is redeemable for gold any longer, they act as if they were and take their supposed value for granted. With Bitcoin, this is not possible because Bitcoin is not a receipt for anything. Bitcoin is the scarce asset its private key represents. This turns everything we thought we knew about money on its head because it exposes the biggest lie we've ever fallen for as a species. The liars in power on top of the food chain of every human hierarchy are losing their ability to spellbind their subjects more and more for every day that passes. The emperor is naked, and Satoshi Nakamoto has pointed it out. Everyone will realize this eventually because it's right in front of their eyes. There is no such thing as a society, and there never was. It was just you, me, and the others all along. There is no we, there is no ours. There are only individuals with different amounts of influence on other individuals. Only an individual can make a decision. Only an individual can claim ownership. Collectivists win because of their ignorance, because of their willingness to be used, because they fail to realize that it's all in their heads. All of it.
We've talked a lot before about the similarities between this book and Jeff's The Price of Tomorrow book. And this is one of those Jeff points here. He says it differently. He says that there is no they instead of there is no we. But I think that it's sort of the same point. Society is you and me. It's human beings. It's individuals. And there is no great big cabal of they that want to kill you. Like, it's just a problem with the system and the incentives in it. And if we can converge around a system that cannot be changed, the rules without rulers, that would be better for everyone.
Love it. And, you know, I think the thing here is that it comes right back to the beginning here, that the argument by the collectivists is that we live in a society, we're all in this together, and we therefore have an obligation towards our fellow man. And you know what? It's totally fine to think that for yourself. But the thing is, it's never the people who are on the giving end who are saying that. Well, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's your Bill Gateses and stuff who theoretically give tons of their money to charities and all this.
He's not on the giving end of anything. He's a taker.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, but theoretically, he's a massive philanthropist or something. But it's the people who would be the beneficiaries of it. Like, everyone is owed this and that, and we're in a society, and this is just how things should work. And the thing is, if you don't agree with that, and I don't think you should agree with that, is these people just cry that you're being unfair, and like, how would you leave and all this, and you know, Atlas Shrugged and Gulch and all this. Like, those of us with any ability to have a say, like, opting out is the way to do it. And I wish it wasn't. Like, this is kind of the thing here. Like, I wish there wasn't so many people who just are greedy and in it for themselves, but not by doing things themselves. They're greedy for other people's, the rewards of other people's efforts. And it's sort of too bad that this is what it comes to, but there really is only one way out.
Greed based on envy. It's a bad thing. Yeah, I'd just like to add some stuff in the end here. Like, if you're curious about the flaws of democracy, I can really recommend a Hans Hermann Hoppe book called Democracy, the God That Failed. He's one of my favorite authors, and there he goes into all sorts of other reasons why democracy is not what you think it is, like how it affects time preference and so on. And that a democratic leader is more like a tenant than an actual house owner. So a monarch in that sense is a better caretaker of the property, the nation, than a temporary leader, because the temporary leader will loot and just take as much as he can, and then he's out of there, whilst the monarch has an incentive to keep the country running for generations. So look up that book, Democracy, the God That Failed. It's great. We'll get into more of this in other chapters, in other books. Maybe not as much about democracy itself, but about the current system and how property rights is the most important thing ever, even more important than freedom of speech. Property rights is what every other freedom is built. It's a basic building block that every other freedom is built upon.
Love it. I think that's a great place to end on here. Why Collectivists Win. Very good chapter. And with that, I think that's it for this episode of the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Just before we wrap up, of course, we have to mention our lovely partnership with Plan B Network, the best place to go for Bitcoin educational resources. And we're really happy to be a part of this wonderful organization. Check out planb.network and you can see everything that they have available on their website. Tons of free courses. Some stuff is paid if you want to go to Lugano and various other places in the world and get like a real major course. And they want help translating everything into as many languages as possible. They're open for volunteers for new courses. So check them out and get involved.
Yeah, and come see us in Lugano at the end of October. We're going to the Plan B conference, the Plan B Forum conference in Lugano on 25th and 26th of October, I believe it is. So come see us there. And also get a hardware wallet. And when you're choosing, we recommend this one. It's a Bitbox. They have a brand new Nova edition out now that you can plug straight into your iPhone and stuff. And they have all the latest and greatest in security technology. This is one of the oldest hardware wallet manufacturers in the world. We're having an episode come out with one of the software engineers here, or hardware engineers, I'd say, or one of the engineers coming soon too. So check that out and check out the Bitbox. You can use code Infinity for a discount on your hardware wallet.
Absolutely perfect. Nothing else to add here. Thank you for joining us. Check out our Geyser Fund page, geyser.fund/project/infinity, if you want to get involved with this project. And thanks for watching. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy.
Bye-bye.